Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. And tonight, this morning, I'm coming to you live from my little studio in old Thornhill Village, just north of Toronto. The British royal family lost its patriarch early Friday morning, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh and royal consort and husband to Queen Elizabeth II, passed away peacefully at Windsor Castle. He was 99. The prince and queen were married for 74 years. Prince Philip retired from public life in 2017. He'll be remembered in part for his numerous light-hearted gaffes over the years. One of his quotes, made to a German newspaper back in 1988, is eerily prophetic. When asked by a reporter with the newspaper what his thoughts were on reincarnation, the prince quipped, "He hoped to come back as a deadly human virus in order to help with the problem of overpopulation." A deadly human virus. Although the last year plus has certainly felt prophetic to many of us, some of us were even wondering if we were witnessing the end times, or the beginning of the end, or maybe the middle of the beginning of the end. Documentary filmmaker and student of biblical prophecy, Ali Siadatan, returns to the program tonight to talk about the different ages of the Bible, including the end of ages, or the end times. And no discussion about the end times would be complete without a discussion of the mysterious and ominous-sounding Mark of the Beast, mentioned in Revelation chapter 13, verses 16 and 17. "And he causes all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. And he provides that no one will be given a mark on their right hand, rather, or he provides that no one will be able to buy or sell, except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name." What does it all mean? What does it mean to accept the mark? What is the mark? What is the purpose of the mark? Ali Siadatan joins me in hours 1 and 2 of the program. In the second half, well, it's Friday. What does that mean? It means, of course, open lines and no politics and no COVID. I would like to discuss inventions tonight, if possible. If you're a backyard tinkerer, or perhaps the reincarnation of Nikola Tesla, or a wannabe Edison, I want to hear from you during our open line segment. Perhaps you've designed a working time machine in your basement, or a perpetual motion machine, or some type of free energy device. Now, it doesn't have to be something out of science fiction. Maybe you're the next Sir James Dyson. Remember what Edison said: to be an inventor, all you need is a good imagination and a pile of junk. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Born in Iran, Ali Siadatan has been involved in a lifelong search into spirituality. He feels that the hand that's guided him through life has led him into the examination of the relationship that exists between angels and UFOs. After finishing a master's degree in French language and literature at the University of Toronto, Ali decided to pursue his passion for the Chinese arts of Kung Fu and Tai Chi and opened a center. Today, joined by his wife, Shelley, they run a martial arts and health center in downtown Toronto. His documentary, UFOs, Angels, and Gods, was his first attempt at directing and writing for the audiovisual arts. His research into UFOs has inspired him to write a fiction book he's working on. And he has also produced another documentary entitled Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans. And he is the founder of the Canadian media production company Think Again Productions. Ali, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Fine. Thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You know, it's interesting. This is something I only recently learned. When we talk about the end times, That's only one of the ages, the end of ages. It's only one of several ages in the Bible. I wasn't aware that there were more than, you know, one age described in the Bible. Tell me about some of these other ages.
Well, there are several different ways that people go ahead and, you know, divide the Bible into ages, but there are three large portions of time that stand out. So the first one goes from Adam all the way to Abraham. And this is often called the Age of Chaos. We see the events that lay the foundation of the fallen world, such as the events of the Garden of Eden, the sons of God who come and have offspring with the daughters of men and create the giants that are submerged by the waters of the flood and, you know, alter DNA. The spirits of the Nephilim continue to be with us to this day. It's a very, very important foundational event for the history of the fallen world. And then we have the story of the Tower of Babel, where all the nations are dispatched from the presence of God. These are all things recorded in the first age. And then with Abraham begins the second age, the character through whom the problems of the world will be healed. Through his seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed, we are told. God begins a giant project of restoration that carries us to the end of history. And so with Abraham begins this age where God's instructions are about to come into the earth. You know, we'll have the story of Moses bringing the Torah, and we will have the birth of the nation of Israel, and we'll have the construction of the first and the second temple, and of course the arrival of the Son of God. These are incredible events that will occur in this second age of history. And then we are now getting to the end of the second age of history, where, you know, Jesus ascends to the Father, to the Ancient of Days, where he receives the scepter of rule over all of creation, as prophesied by the Old Testament scriptures, the Son of Man. He then sits at the right hand of God. He sends the Holy Spirit as a sign of the new covenant to the earth that changes the spiritual makeup of the world, transitioning the earth from the age of polytheism into the age of monotheism. He then, the temple again gets destroyed. So his resurrection, which is, you know, remembered at Easter and at Passover, phenomenally important event, the most important spiritual event of all of history. If it's true, then nothing can really beat it. His ascension, his receiving of power, his sending of the Spirit, and then the destruction of the second temple. On the same day, on the 9th of Av, the Romans destroy the temple on the same day that the Babylonians had destroyed it centuries ago. I mean, two empires unrelated to each other, through events unrelated to each other, destroy the temple on the same day of the Jewish calendar, the 9th of Av, and that day has significance going all the way back to the very beginnings of the story of Israel. So these events mark the beginning of a new age, and this new age, Peter declares, on the day of Pentecost, which is one of the appointed days of God's prophetic calendar, Peter declares, as he stands up, dipped in this Spirit of God that comes over this fisherman from Galilee, and everyone is listening to him, and people are wondering what's going on, people think, why are they speaking in different languages? Are they drunk? He says, for these people are not drunk, as you suppose, since it is only the third hour of the day. But this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel, and in the last days it shall be, God declares. So Peter essentially declares in that moment, by using the word last days, by quoting the prophecy of Joel, that a new age, the final age, has begun. And this is the beginning of the Messianic Age. That is the age in which we are living. This is the beginning of the Messianic Age. The Messiah is being declared to all the nations, and at his return he will establish a kingdom, which is the second stage of the Messianic Age. It's one of the important events of the Messianic Age. It's called the Messianic Kingdom, and that will last, of course, 1,000 years, after which God himself arrives and the heavenly Jerusalem is established, which is the final of all the biblical ages.
All right, so, okay, let's just back up. So we had the Age of Chaos, and that is basically sort of laid out in Genesis. We have the Age of Torah, which is Abraham and then later Moses. We have the Messianic Age with Jesus, the resurrection. So where is the end of ages, the end times? Is okay, that part so of the Messianic Age?
Well, that's very interesting because so Peter declares that essentially the last days have already begun. Paul, in his writings, refers to the fact that this world is already done. These guys believed that since Jesus had received the scepter of rule and had ascended and had atoned, this was it, the end of this world as we know it, the age of empires, of fallen angels, of corruption, of pain, of suffering. All of this had essentially began to collapse. It's a process. So Peter declares the beginning of the end times on the day of Pentecost 2,000 years ago. For 2,000 years, we have been living the age that the Bible refers to as the end times. Now, it has a climactic finalness to it. It's like a birth pang. The birth pangs begin. The water breaks. This age starts to go into convulsion in order to give birth to the next age of history where the Messianic kingdom established. And often in our general culture, in our just everyday sit around, you know, a cup of tea and cup of coffee and talk about these deep mysteries, in our general culture, we tend to call that final portion the end times, where it starts to become very apocalyptic, you know, like COVID and all that stuff.
Ah, yes.
But biblically...
Right. I was just going to ask you about that, because when we think of end times, we go right to the apocalypse, right? Is that inaccurate to do that? We focus on the apocalypse when we think of the end times.
Well, yes, it is biblically it's biblically inaccurate, yes. It's more of a common culture thing. You know, it's like we are interested in the final fireworks that launch us into the next age, the Messianic kingdom, where the Lord returns and establishes that kingdom. But biblically speaking, a day can be a long time in the Bible. So when we say the day of the Lord or the last days, it doesn't necessarily mean it's just a short amount of time. And so Peter himself declares it. In fact, you want to know something very interesting? All the way back in the book of Genesis, in the first of all the books, in the book of the beginning, where the third of the patriarchs, Jacob, there's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob is on his deathbed, and he calls his 12 children who are going to become world famous. They're going to become, the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel, whose names are even recorded on the heavenly Jerusalem of God in the final, eon of history. But he summons those 12 sons to his deathbed, and he says to them, Jacob called his sons and said to them, "Gather together so that I can tell you what will happen to you in the last days." What will happen to you in the last days? That's actually the first place where this term is mentioned in the Bible. It's when the patriarch Jacob calls his 12 children and says to them, "Let me tell you what's going to happen to you in the last days." We also have, God comes, sends an angel to Daniel, who lived about 500 years before Christ, and he gives him this incredible knowledge about what is going to occur, and the angel says to him, "But you, Daniel, close up the words and seal the book until the time of the end." And that's, again, the same word, acharit hayamim is the word in Hebrew, which means the end of days. And so then Peter takes all of these ideas and dips in the Holy Spirit. 2,000 years ago on the day of Pentecost, he declares it. He says, "We have now entered into this final age of history. The signs are upon us. God said he would send his Spirit to all flesh. And that is what we see beginning in Jerusalem. We see the wind of the Spirit pouring over all the nations, the Greeks, the Romans, the Mesopotamians, the Persians, the Chinese, the Indians, the Egyptians, all the way throughout the generations to this day, all the way into the shores of California. The Spirit pours, and that is what brings a spiritual upheaval, part of which is people realize who this Jesus guy was. You know, his name...
Now, if Jacob was on his... If Jacob was on his deathbed and he called his 12 children, who would then be the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel, and said and talked about the end times, doesn't that suggest very, very strongly that the end times would be played out during their lifetime? Or was he talking somewhat metaphorically, saying, you know, your descendants?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So in the prophetic Hebrew poetry, time is a little bit more circular than in the Greek linear way of looking at it, where every event in the Greek thinking has a finality. You know, this happened, this is going to happen, it happens, and it's done. In the Hebrew prophetic poetry, it is a declaration of a pattern that will begin sometimes in the time of the prophet's own life and will carry out over and over in history until the pattern is completed. It has landmarks, it has moments of, you know, flowering and completion, and ultimately it's done and the pattern stops. So he is declaring things over his children that will bear into, as you say, the destiny of generations of each one of the tribes with points of finality. For instance, he says the scepter will come from Judah. Okay, well, we know that, you know, the king, David, was from the tribe of Judah. And all the kings, you know, came from the house of David. God made a covenant with the house of King David, saying that the kings would come from him. You know, Solomon was his son. There was a civil war in Israel, but nonetheless, God made a covenant with the house of David and only with the house of David. And ultimately, God reveals that he has an eternal king in mind who will come from the line of David. And Gabriel says to Mary that her supernatural child is that prophesied king, and he will become the eternal king. So Jacob's words to Judah find their finality in the person of Jesus Christ, who becomes this eternal king from whom the scepter will never depart. But on the way to him, the tribe of Judah will produce many, many kings, because it is from Judah that the principle of rulership, the scepter of rulership, will emanate from that tribe. That's one example of this pattern that he speaks over them. So
right.
Everything finds its conclusion eventually in the last days. The things that he speaks over his children have their finality, their final flowering and fulfillment at the end of this age in which you and I are living.
Okay, so the idea that we are, you know, in the end times.
Right.
There is a school of thought that the end times, or at least the book of Revelation, which talks a lot about, you know, the end of days and the tribulation and so forth, that it was written for the benefit of the faithful in the Roman Empire in the second century, that it was encouraging the faithful to hang on to their faith. It was written in veiled language so that the Christians would understand and the non-Christian Romans would not. The idea, you know, the beast, which we'll talk about later, the beast is Rome, the harlot that is drunk with the blood of the saints is also Rome. So in other words, there are no predictions in the book that are applicable to current events. We're approaching a break here at the bottom of the hour, but I'll get you to start to talk about that, and then we'll continue after the break. So how do you respond to that sort of version of the end times, that it was meant for people in the second century?
I see what you're saying. Which school of thought, you know, is the accurate one? The people say it was all fulfilled. You know, everything that was in that book was already done at the time of Jesus, and that's it. Even all the entire book of Revelation has been already fulfilled. And the next stop, eventually we continue to preach the gospel to all the whole world. More and more people will believe, and eventually Jesus, at some unknown time, surprises the world, and everyone ascends into the heavenly Jerusalem. and that's it. So that version is called preterism. It's a way of dividing the Bible. I don't think it agrees with what I would call the whole counsel of God, meaning that if you took into consideration the unfulfilled prophecies of the Old Testament, and there are many of them, that actually talk about things that involve the nation of Israel and have never been fulfilled, if you take that into consideration, you realize there are many things spoken about that nation in the Old Testament that have never been fulfilled by the second century.
Okay. Ali, I got to jump in here. We're going to take a timeout. We'll come back and discuss further, back with more of Coast to Coast right after this. Welcome back. Sitting in for George Norrie, say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. A Russian politician who once presided over parts of Siberia has revealed he had a hand in hoaxing Yeti sightings in the hopes of drawing tourists to the area. Aman Tuliev, a former governor of the Kemerovo region of the country, recounted the remarkable tale this past Thursday on his Instagram account, responding to the question of whether or not a Yeti still roamed the remote area he once governed. The politician first noted that legends of the creature have long circulated among hunters in the Sharia Mountains, and that he had once made a journey of his own to this location in search of the cryptid. That said, Tuliev then made a rather surprising confession. He said, "It was I who fueled interest in the Yeti." You can see or read more of that story in the Highlight Carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. Back with more of my conversation with documentary filmmaker Alice Yadatan as we discuss the end times right here on Coast to Coast AM. Alice Yadatan, the founder of Think Again Productions, is with us, and we're talking about the end times and other biblical ages, and later we'll get into a discussion of the tribulation, Mark of the Beast, and so forth. But before the break, Ali, we were talking about this idea, this one version of, I guess, Christian eschatology that suggests that the end times and the book of Revelation was written really for the benefit of the people living in the second century, and all the prophecies were sort of fulfilled there, that the beast mentioned in Revelation was actually Rome, and that the harlot that is drunk with the blood of the saints was also about Rome and the destruction of the Second Temple and so forth. And you're saying that doesn't quite work in terms of biblical prophecy. So let's just continue with that idea.
Yes. When you take into consideration the whole counsel of God and all the unfulfilled prophecies of the Old Testament, of which there are many, Israel is a character of biblical history. The story is told through them, but it concerns the whole world. It's just you can't write a book about every country, and when the Chinese will do this, and the Koreans will do that. So God is telling a story of the world through the eyes of one nation. There are many things that have not been fulfilled in the Old Testament concerning that nation. The whole idea of spiritualizing the story of the Bible, that doesn't jive with the physical resurrection of Jesus. When Jesus comes back from the dead, he says, "Give me some food to eat, touch my wounds. I am not a ghost, I'm flesh and bone." He goes and sits at the right hand of the Father until, it says, his enemies are made a footstool, and then he's sent back to the earth with an army of angels to then establish a kingdom. And I think later we're going to talk about that as we talk about the very end of this age and the transition to the next. I can open up the passages and show so many things that have not been fulfilled. Finally, the whole concept, the whole idea behind biblical prophecy is that God is revealing the future of history. Never anywhere in the Bible is the prophecies not to be taken literally. Even things like the virgin birth or the fact that the Messiah would be crucified and die and come back to life, things that were highly unlikely. It was easy for someone to sit and say, "No, probably these are symbols and metaphors. Come on, this can't actually happen. Who's ever heard of a virgin birth? Who's ever heard of someone coming back from the dead?" Well, even those things actually occurred literally. Yes, the Bible uses symbols and metaphors and similes and figures of speech, as a way of telling the actual history of the human race and God's vision and where God is taking it. And there's something comforting about that because it shows us that there is a plan, that God is ultimately in control, and that he has a vision and a place it's all going, and he's sharing that with us. And life then finds meaning. Because it's like someone turns the volume on. You're seeing random events, but you don't know what's going on. And then the Bible comes and says, this is what's going on. So if it was all just fulfilled and everything else in that book was just symbolic of a spiritual war or spoke of a realm not of here, it suddenly disconnects with the way that prophecy has functioned so far in the Bible. And
right.
Now that school of thought became a big one, I know, but I don't believe it's accurate.
Okay, so why does the end time seem to be unfolding over such a vast period of time? So, for example, back in the year 999, let's say, and as the year is drawing to a close, and people are thinking, okay, it's going to be the year 1000. There were Christians that withdrew to some mountaintop in Europe. They were expecting
right.
the end when the year 1000 rolled around, and of course, obviously, we're still here. So, but why? And with Y2K, of course, there was
right.
Some expectation at the end. Why does it take so long?
Because there are many souls that need to be born that have a destiny in the eternal kingdom of God. This is the incubation chamber, the harvesting place of the immortal children of God who will have a destiny in the future of the cosmos. That is what the earth is. And so there, God is patient as all the people are being born that are going to hear this message and be harvested, or, maybe that's not a good word for it, but who are going to be welcomed into his kingdom. So there, it's not just about you and I. Once you and I, die, then there's another guy being born in the next generation who also has a place, and we've got to wait for him. So why does it take so long? Well, because the number of the people that is born over a series of generations. Why does it take so long? Because there's a multitude of events that are occurring in this age of history, of which the apocalyptic birth pangs are also kind of an end. So there's more than just, the apocalypse that's going to happen in this end time age. The Holy Spirit is being given to all the nations of the earth. And the nations are entering into fellowship with the living God, which is something they lost at the Tower of Babel. They're getting to know who this king is, this son of David, son of God, this messianic king who's going to rule over the universe. They're getting to know him. All the people that need to receive this are being born. Israel is going for a great wandering. A final imperial age under the influence of Satan is unfolding, and Rome is the age that we still find ourselves in, since we can see that the eagles of Rome stand tall from Moscow to D.C. all the way through the European capitals. Rome has continued strong. It is the part of the world with the most powerful army, with the most advanced science and technology, with the greatest economy, with the greatest political influence. It has never ceased. Now, the prophecies concerning the Roman Empire, the periods of persecution, as well as, the harlot and the seven hills, and people try to take the Caesars and say, look, there are so many Caesars, and this corresponds to the heads of the dragon. Well, again, it goes back to this need that the Greek way of reading the Bible has under the influence of Greek culture, which is very linear. The understanding
right.
that the themes of the Bible may apply to that time and continue to climax and apply to a final age where all the signs that have not been fulfilled come together. That is another way of understanding it through the Hebrew prophetic.
Right. There are always people who believe that they've figured out God's clock and they know the hour and the day and so forth.
Right.
Because in the Bible, the disciples kind of give the impression that it can happen any time.
Yes.
But you say that there are still prophecies yet to be fulfilled, and therefore the clock, you know, hasn't run out yet. So what are some of those prophecies that have yet to be fulfilled that we are looking toward?
Well, I have to preface the answer by saying that it is a revealing thing. You know, the book of the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, it's called Apocalypsis in Greek. In English, it's Revelation. In the sense of unveiling, that which was previously hidden is shown. And right now, we are just, I would say, entering the time of the unveiling, of the book of unveiling. We are about to now start to understand this mysterious book that no one has ever fully understood. So the Bible is something that God reveals its content to different generations through the Holy Spirit. And so it's not like we have all the entire answer to exactly these are the things that are ahead of us, and this is how it's going to come, and this is what's going to happen. It's an unfolding reality as God communicates to his people. So what we can see so far is that after the Protestant Reformation, when the scriptures came out and began to be translated into the language of all the people of Europe and be read, and people started to align their understanding with the Bible, starting with how is one saved, you know, how does one become righteous before God, only by faith in Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection, and calling him king, allegiance to his coming kingdom. Gradually we start to see that people start to turn their minds and heart to the sections of the Bible that seem to talk about the end of this age and the beginning of the next. And we start to see literature coming up, and some very important writers come up and start to talk about this. And so we start to see that it actually taken literally, since all the prophecies of the Bible occur literally on the stage of actual history, it seems that they all involve somehow in the presence of the Jewish people in this land that was ancestrally where they lived, where biblically they were brought. And eventually, it seems that they're coming back to this land, the Aliyah, it's called, the return to this land, begins a process and a series of events that leads to the second coming of Christ. Scholars in Europe, such as Schofield and Darby and others, they begin to see this, even older than them. Spurgeon already is talking about it. They start to see that, you know, this is going to happen on the stage of history, and somehow this is related to the events that are going to continue. Obviously, the final culmination of this regathering of the Jewish people to this land occurs under the Messiah at his return, but its beginnings start to usher in events that lead to his coming. So that's an important sign. And so we start to see that at the beginning of the 20th century, there's movement in that direction. And even before that, there's this compelling, you know, the Christians in the British Empire, they start to say, we are compelled by God's Spirit to facilitate this process. I mean, the Lord Balfour, the Balfour Declaration of 1917, he was one of these Christian Zionists, they were called. So even before God, it seemed, made the way ready in the hearts and minds of Christians. And then the Jewish idea started to grow. You know, there was Herzl and all of that. And so it started to lead in that direction. So that's an important sign, I would say. Another sign is Jerusalem itself as a city. There are prophecies in the Bible that involve the city of Jerusalem and involve contention around Jerusalem. Probably the most famous is Zechariah chapter 14 that paints an incredibly detailed picture of the last moments of this age. It's like a camera. It's like a movie. You read that chapter, it's so detailed, and it shows you the last scene, the last moments of this
age.
What does it say? It says, behold, a day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided in your midst. I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to wage war. So it starts by saying that all the nations gather against Jerusalem. There are three world wars. The first one is the one that removes the Turkish caliphate, and suddenly this land that had been lost for 2,000 years returns into the, it starts to come out and come into the hand of the British. The Second World War with the Holocaust returns this land to the Jewish people, and it seems that this prophecy concerns the third great war, which brings the Messiah of Israel back, and it says that as the nations gather, then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations, as he fights in a day of battle. In that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which lies to the east of Jerusalem. And so he lands, with his angel army, he lands on the Mount of Olives, which is just outside of the city of Jerusalem's, you know, downtown where the temple is, across from the Temple Mount. And then it says that now this is the plague with which the Lord will strike all the people that wage war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets. Their tongues will rot in their mouths. It will happen in that day that a great panic from the Lord will be among them. So it's this idea of eyes and rotting and things, flesh rotting, it sounds to me like nearly like a nuclear blast, because, you know, from my study of the angelic world and the UFO phenomenon, I think that the armies of God coming from heaven also utilize the types of thing that we use. You know, like we know how to break the atom, we know about laser, who knows what else these guys have, but they are using the laws of the creation as they return to the earth. The enemies are pushed away. Then all the survivors from all the nations that attacked Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of Heaven's armies, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. So all the nations, the survivors, because there will be survivors, the survivors of this final war, this third world war that involves the city of Jerusalem, will then go year after year to worship the King on the Feast of Tabernacle, which is the seventh of the appointed days that begin with Passover, where the Lord was crucified, buried, and resurrected during Passover. Pentecost is when the Holy Spirit was given. That was another one of his appointed days. And then in the fall, in the feasts, there are three appointed days. The last one is the Feast of Tabernacle, which is the Feast of Ingathering of the Harvest. Finally, all the harvest of the nations is complete, and people come to worship the King. And I know that someone hearing this might think, this is awful. Like, what you're reading is horrible. Like, war, destruction, what's going on? Well, you know, it's a purging of something that is dark. So I think that once we're living it, we'll be happy that something very dark, you know, it's like when the Nazis fell and Hitler died, I don't think anyone was thinking, oh, whoa, no, what's going on? Everyone was like, thank God. So I think it's that kind of a thing, first of all. And so
what you're describing, is that the Battle of Armageddon?
Yes. This is the Battle of Armageddon.
Okay.
It is part and parcel. Now, the Battle of Armageddon occurs in the fields of Megiddon. That's why it's called Har Megiddon. It means, you know, the field of Megiddon, of Megiddo, Jezreel. And ironically, if you go to Israel today and go to that place, it is completely open. They haven't built anything. It's just sitting there, this giant field. It's a military base. The oldest and most ancient recorded wars of history are fought there by this Egyptian pharaoh. It is one of the spots on the earth where the most amount of wars are fought, because Israel is...
All right, Ali, I got to stop you there. I got to jump in because we're approaching the break at the top of the hour. We'll continue this fascinating discussion in hour two. At the bottom of the next hour, we'll open up the phones and take questions and comments. Ali Siadatan, the founder of Think Again Productions, documentary filmmaker, UFOs, Angels, and Gods. We're discussing the end times, and we will get around to the Mark of the Beast. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM.